Hi everybody, welcome to the Young People's Program. Today, a story by Oscar Wilde will start off, and then Young Poets Speak, another in the programs in which young poets read and discuss their own poems. Time for music follows, and then a story from Dr. Seuss called The King's Stilts, and finally, What's Going On. Here then is John Graham reading The Selfish Giant by Oscar Wilde.
Every afternoon, as they were coming from school, the children used to go and play in the giant's garden. It was a large, lovely garden with soft green grass. Here and there, over the grass, stood beautiful flowers like stars. And there were 12 peach trees that in the springtime broke out into delicate blossoms of pink and pearl, and in the autumn bore rich fruit. The birds sat on the trees and sang so sweetly that the children used to stop their games in order to listen to them. "How happy we are here!" they cried to each other. One day, the giant came back. He had been to visit his friend, the Cornish Urg, and had stayed with him for 7 years. After the 7 years were over, he had said all that he had to say, for his conversation was limited, and he determined to return to his own castle. When he arrived, he saw the children playing in the garden.
"What are you doing there?"
he cried in a great, gruff voice, and the children ran away.
"My own garden is my own garden. Anyone can understand that, and I will allow nobody to play in it but myself."
So he built a high wall around it and put up a notice board that read, "Trespassers will be prosecuted." He was a very selfish giant. The poor children had now nowhere to play. They tried to play on the road, but the road was very dusty and full of hard stones, and they did not like it. They used to wander round the high wall when their lessons were over and talk about the beautiful garden inside. "How happy we were there," they said to each other. Then the spring came, and all over the country there were little blossoms and little birds. Only in the garden of the selfish giant, it was still winter. Still winter. The birds did not care to sing in it, as there were no children, and the trees forgot to blossom. Once a beautiful flower put its head out from the grass, but when it saw the notice board, it was so sorry for the children that it slipped back into the ground again and went off to sleep. The only people who were pleased were the snow and the frost. "Spring has forgotten this garden," they cried, "so we will live here all year round." The snow covered up the grass with her great white cloak, and the frost painted all the trees silver. Then they invited the North Wind to stay with them, and he came. He was wrapped in furs, and he roared all day about the garden and blew the chimney pots down.
"Oh, this is a delightful spot. We must ask the hail on a visit."
So the hail came. Every day for 3 hours it rattled on the roof of the castle till it broke some and most of the slates. And then he ran round and round the garden as fast as he could, as fast as he could go. He was dressed in gray, and his breath was like ice.
"Oh, I cannot understand why the spring is so late in coming," said the selfish giant as he sat in the window and looked out at the cold white garden. "I hope there will be a change in the weather."
But the spring never came, nor the summer. The autumn gave golden fruit to every garden, but to the giant's garden she gave none. "He is too selfish," she said. So it was always winter there, and the north wind and the hail and the frost and the snow danced about and through the trees. One morning the giant was lying awake in the bed when he heard some lovely music. It sounded so sweet to his ears that he thought it must be the king's musicians passing by. It was really only a little linnet singing outside his window. But it was so long since he had heard a bird sing in his garden that it seemed to him that it must be the most beautiful music in the world. Then the hail stopped dancing over his head. The north wind ceased roaring. And a delicious perfume came to him through the open casement.
"I believe the spring has come at last," said the giant.
And he jumped out of bed and looked out. What did he see? He saw a most wonderful sight. Through a little hole in the wall, the children had crept in, and they were sitting in the branches of the trees. In every tree that he could see, there was a little child, and the trees were so glad to have the children back again that they had covered themselves with blossoms and were waving their arms gently, gently over the children's heads. The birds were flying about and twittering with delight. The flowers were looking up through the green grass and laughing. It was a lovely scene. Only in one corner, it was still winter. It was the father's corner of the garden, and in it was standing a little boy. He was so small that he could not reach up to the branches of the tree, and he was wandering all around it, crying bitterly. The poor tree was still quite covered with frost and snow, and the north wind was blowing and roaring about it. "Climb up, little boy," said the tree, and it bent its branches down as low as it could, but the boy was too tiny. And the giant's heart melted as he looked out.
"How selfish I have been," he said. "Now I know why the spring would not come here. I will put the poor little boy on the top of the tree, and then I will knock down the wall, and my garden shall be the children's playground forever and ever."
He was really very sorry for what he had done. So he crept downstairs and opened the front door quite softly and went out into the garden. But when the children saw him, they were so frightened that they all ran away, and the garden became winter again. Only the little boy did not run, for his eyes were so full of tears he did not see the giant coming. And the giant stole up behind him and took him gently in his hand and put him up into the tree. And the tree broke at once into blossoms, and the birds came and sang on it, and the little boy stretched out his two arms and flung them round the giant's neck and kissed him. And the other children, when they saw that the giant was not wicked any longer, came running back, and with them came the spring.
"It is your garden now, little children," said the giant. And he took a great axe and knocked down the wall.
And when the people were going to market at 12 o'clock, they found the giant playing with the children in the most beautiful garden that they had ever seen. All day long they played, and in the evening they came to the giant to bid him goodbye.
"But where is your little companion, the boy I put in the tree?"
The giant loved him the best because he had kissed him. "We don't know," answered the children. "He's gone away."
"You must tell him to be sure and come here tomorrow," said the giant.
But the children said that they did not know where he lived and had never seen him before. And the giant felt very sad. Every afternoon when school was over, the children came and played with the giant. But the little boy whom the giant loved was never seen again. The giant was very kind to all the children. Yet he longed for his first little friend and often spoke of him.
"How I would like to see him," he used to say.
Years went on, and the giant grew very old and feeble. He could not play about anymore, so he sat in a huge armchair and watched the children at their games and admired his garden.
"I have many beautiful flowers, but the children are the most beautiful flowers of all."
One winter morning, he looked out of his window as he was dressing. He did not hate the winter now, for he knew that it was merely the spring asleep, and that the flowers were resting. Suddenly, he rubbed his eyes in wonder, and looked and looked. It certainly was a marvelous sight. In the farthest corner of the garden, there was a tree, quite covered with lovely white blossoms. Its branches were all golden, and silver fruit hung down from them. And underneath it stood the little boy he'd loved. Downstairs ran the giant in great joy, and out into the garden. He hesitated. Then he hastened across the grass and came near the child. And when he came quite close, his face grew red with anger, and he said,
"Who hath dared to wound thee?"
For on the palms of the child's hands were the prints of two nails, and the prints of two nails were on his little feet.
"Who hath dared to wound thee?" cried the giant. Tell me that I may take my big sword and slay him."
"Nay," answered the child, "but these are the wounds of love."
"Who art thou?"
said the giant, and a strange awe fell on him, and he knelt before the small child. And the child smiled on the giant and said to him, "You let me play once in your garden. Today You shall come with me to my garden, which is paradise. And when the children ran in that afternoon, they found the giant lying dead under the tree, all covered with white blossoms.
Story, and there'll be some more coming along now in just a little bit. There's, I think, a couple of folk songs and singing, and then there's another story. I was recording the first story, and I left the recorder on while I was at dinner and recorded the second story. I haven't heard it myself. I hope you'll enjoy it, though. I'm also working on a story that I'm going to tell on a tape one of these days. It has sound effects to go with it. It's a story about an old friend of yours. In fact, a friend of both of ours. And I think maybe you can guess who it is. And it's complete with sound effects and everything else. So I'm still working on it. I've written most of it out. And I have a record of sound effects.
These are American folk songs, and the singers are Milt Oaken and Bob Gibson.
Well, she promised us folk songs. Where are they? Here they come.
I'll give to you a paper of pins, for that's the way my love begins. If you will marry, marry me, you will marry me.
No, I'll not accept your paper of pins, if that's the way our love begins. No, I'll not marry, marry you, no, I'll not marry you.
I'll give to you a dress of red, stitched around with a golden thread. If you will marry, marry me, you will marry me.
No, I'll not accept your dress of red, stitched all around with a golden thread. No, I'll not marry, marry you, no, I'll not marry you.
I'll give to you a house and land that you may have at your command. If you will marry, marry me, you will marry me.
No, I'll not accept your house and land that I might have at my command. No, I'll not marry, marry you. No, I'll not marry you.
I'll give to you the key to my heart that we might marry and never part. If you will marry, marry me, you will marry me.
No, I'll not accept the key to your heart that we might marry and never part. No, I'll not marry, marry you. No, I'll not marry you.
I'll give to you the key to my chest that you may have gold at your request. If you will marry, marry me, if you will marry me.
Yes, I'll accept the key to your chest that I might have money at my request. Yes, I will marry, marry you. Yes, I will marry you.
Now you love coffee and you love tea. You love my money, but you don't love me. So I won't marry, marry you. I won't marry you. Will you wear red, oh my dear, will you wear red, Jenny Jenkins?
No, I won't wear red, it's the color of my head. Gonna buy me a foldy, roly, piddly, foldy, seeky, double use across the road to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll.
Will you wear green, oh my dear, will you wear green, Jenny Jenkins?
No, I won't wear green, it's a shame to be seen. Gonna buy me a foldy, roly, piddly, foldy, seeky, double use across the road to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll.
Will you wear yellow, oh my dear, will you wear yellow, Jenny Jenkins?
No, I won't wear yellow, cause I got my fellow, gonna buy me a foldy, roly, tiddly, dolly, seek a double, use a cause a roll to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll.
Will you wear purple, oh my dear, will you wear purple, Jenny Jenkins?
No, I won't wear purple, it's the color of a turtle, gonna buy me a foldy, roly, tiddly, dolly, seek a double, use a cause a roll to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll.
Will you wear orange, oh my dear, will you wear orange, Jenny Jenkins?
No, orange I won't wear, and it rhymes, so there. Gonna find me a foldy, roly, tiddly, goldy, seek a double, use a cause a roll to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll.
What will you wear, oh my dear, then what will you wear, Jenny Jenkins?
Oh, what do I care if I just go bare? Gonna buy me a foldy, roly, tiddly, goldy, seek a double, use a cause a roll to find me. Roll, Jenny Jenkins, roll.
There's a few turns of the tape here that are blank, and then I think there's some more songs that I recorded. They're not terribly good, but it's something. And then I think the next story is a little bit further on. Just be patient, it'll come on here in a minute. You can whistle while you're waiting for the music to come on.
Here tonight, I know you by your friendly face. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. I know you by your friendly face. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. Good Lord, I'm glad you came along. Hope all the brothers and the sisters here will help me sing this song. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. I know you by your friendly face. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting out in the wilderness. A meeting here tonight. We ain't gonna give that sinner no chance. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. I know you by your friendly face. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. Good Lord, glad you came along. Hope all the brothers and the sisters here will help me sing this song. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. I know you by your friendly face. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. I know you by your friendly face. There's a meeting here tonight. There's a meeting here tonight. Day-o, day-o, day delight and the one go home. Day-o, day-o, day delight and the one go home. One day me go over bay, day delight and the one go home. A loading bananas for a dollar a day. Oh, day, oh, day, oh. Day, delight, and me won't go home. Oh, day, oh, day, oh. Day, delight, and me won't go home. Come, Mr. Tallyman, tally me bananas. Day, delight, and me won't go home. Take 7 hands to make a bunch. Day, delight, and me won't go home. I work all night, sing this song. Day, delight, and me won't go home. The tallyman count along. Day, delight, and they won't go home. Oh, day, oh, day, oh. Day, delight, and they won't go home. Oh, day, oh, day, oh. Day, delight, and they won't go home. Boss man, listen to me. Day, delight, and they won't go home. Matilda's waiting, waiting for me. Day, delight, and they won't go home. I'll own bananas all night long. Day, delight, and they won't go home. It's almost day. Day, delight, and me won't go home. Come, Mr. Bossman, here I say. Day, delight, and me won't go home. I did my work and get me pay. Day, delight, and me won't go home. Oh, day, oh, day, oh. Day, delight, and me won't go home. Oh, day, oh, day, oh. Day, delight, and me won't go
Milt Okun and Bob Gibson were the singers of those American folk songs. And now, another story. Sheldon Rudolph reads it.
Hi, boys and girls. I'm Sheldon Rudolph, and once again, it's time for Tell Me Again Tales. Today we have a story called The King's Stilts, and it was written by Dr. Seuss. Let's begin. Naturally, the king never wore his stilts during business hours. When King Bertram worked, he really worked, and his stilts stood forgotten in the tall stilt closet in the castle's front hallway. There was so much work to be done in the kingdom of Bin that King Bertram had to get up every morning at 5. Long before the townsfolk and the farmers were awake, the king was splashing away in his bath. It was right there, in fact, that his day's work began. With his left hand, he could bathe with his royal bath brush, but his right hand always had to be kept dry for signing the important papers of state. Eric, his page boy, brought in these papers on a big silver tray. He stood at attention at the foot of the tub while old Lord Droon took the papers one by one and held them over the water for His Majesty to sign.
Sign here, sign there, old Droon would say, and hurry, sire, hurry, there are hundreds more to come.
It was just the same at breakfast. The king cut and buttered his toast with only his left hand. With his right, he kept signing royal orders and commands. By 7 every morning, the king had always finished more business than most kings do in a month. He had to get all this done before 7, for that was the hour when his big work commenced, the most difficult and important work in the whole kingdom of Bin. This was the work of caring for the mighty dike trees that protected the people of Bin from the sea. The sea pushed against the kingdom on 3 sides. The kingdom was a low one, the sea was a high one, and only the dike trees kept the sea from pouring in. They grew so close together in a row along the shore that they held back the water with their heavy, knotted roots. But to keep these trees strong and sturdy was not an easy task. They were more spicy than pine trees, and their roots were very tasty to a certain sort of bird. This was kind of a giant blackbird with a sharp and pointed beak. Nizzards they were called by the people of Bin. These nizzards were always flying about over the dike trees, waiting for a chance to swoop down and peck. If nobody stopped them, the roots would soon give way. Then the sea would pour in with a terrible roar, and every last soul in the kingdom would drown. But King Bertram did not permit this to happen. He had gathered together in his kingdom the largest and smartest cats in all the world, and had trained them to chase the nizzards away. These cats were called patrol cats, and wore badges that said P.C. "Everything in Bin," said King Bertram, "depends on our patrol cats. They are the most important things in our kingdom. They keep the nizzards away from the dike trees, and the dike trees keep the ocean back out of our land." 1,000 cats in all. They divided up the work. 500 guarded the kingdom by day. The other 500 kept watch through the night. At 7 every morning came the changing of the cat guard. At the sound of a trumpet, the king left his breakfast and mounted his horse for the daily review. Fresh, brisk, and well-fed, the 500 day cats marched past him toward the dike trees to take up their watch. At the same time, the night cats, muddy, tired, and hungry, headed home to their kennels for their 12 hours rest. There was rest for the cats. There was none for the king. It took every minute of his morning to see that they had given him time to make sure that the cats had the very best care. The huts that they slept in must be kept clean and tidy. Each cat must be brushed and his whiskers trimmed just so. The cat kitchen was even bigger and grander than the king's, and the cooks who did the cooking were the chief cooks in the land. "Your Majesty," the chief in charge of fish would always say, "tell us that you think the food we feed our cats is perfect." And the king would look over the huge wet baskets of fish, choosing only the finest and freshest to serve to his patrol cats. So went the morning. Then all afternoon, both in winter and summer, the king made his rounds by the edge of the sea. Every root of every dike tree he inspected every day. But finally, at 5 o'clock, the great task was finished. And the king smiled. A hard day, full of nizzardly worries. A long day. Now it's time for some fun. This was the moment King Bertram lived for. When he worked, he really worked. But when he really played. "Quick, Eric! Quick, Eric! The stilts!" Down the slope from the dike trees, away from all troubles, the king and Eric would race like two boys straight to the tall stilt closet in the castle's front hallway. Out came the stilts. Up leapt the king. Up leapt the king, right into the air, his royal robes streaming. He'd race through the marble halls, out across the terrace, up and down the garden stairs. Black-spotted coach dogs barked and romped beside him, nipping at the heels of his flashing red stilts. The townsfolk looked on from the walls and just loved it. A grown-up king on stilts, they'd say. He does look rather strange, but it's hard work being king, and he does his work well. If he wants to have a bit of fun, sure, let him have it. But there was one man in Bin who didn't like fun. He didn't like games. He didn't like laughing. This man was a scowler. This man was Lord Droon.
"Laughing spoils the shape of the face. Lines at the corner of the mouth should go down."
Every afternoon, when the stilt hour drew near, Lord Droon would slink over to his room in the Northwest Tower and sulk.
"Such carryings on. Look at his crown bouncing up and down on the side of his head. Look at him laughing right out in broad daylight in front of the townsfolk. I must do something about this."
And one day he did. One Wednesday, just before supper, when he thought the king was out, Lord Droon tiptoed down to the front hall. Without the smallest sound on the hard stone floor, Droon crept to the stilt closet, pulled back the ancient door, and reached in. It took only a second. He had the king's stilts. He unbuttoned the top of his long robe and shoved them up inside. Then he sneaked past the guards again and slipped through the door. Down the steep, slanting stairway, Lord Droon marched with the stilts. Down to the furnace to burn them.
"This is the end of the king's foolish stilt walking."
Then suddenly, from around the bend of the stairs below, came the sound of the king. Lord Droon stopped still, almost frozen with fright. He tugged and pulled at his long, flowing gown, struggling to cover the stilts, but he couldn't. The ends were too long and stuck out.
Drone, drone,
gasped Lord Drone.
You'll be caught.
He turned and fled back up the stairway. He looked up and saw a window. Stepping up to it quickly, he poked his head out. He looked down into an alley. A small boy was passing. It was Eric, the page boy.
Psst, you, you.
Lord Drone hissed in a hoarse, nervous whisper.
Yes, sir,
said Eric.
Take these stilts. Take them away, bury them. Deep where no one can find them. Bury them by the sea, by the dike trees.
Lord Drone flung the stilts from the window. The king's stilts? Bury them? Eric didn't know what to think.
It'll spoil His Majesty's fun.
You're impudent. I said bury those stilts. What's more, young man, don't you ever come back or have you locked up? I'll have no impudent boy around this castle.
But I'm the king's own page boy,
gasped Eric.
You were the king's own page boy.
Drone pulled his head in and slammed down the window. Never before had Eric been so puzzled. Never in his life had he felt so sad. But there was nothing to do but obey the command. He picked up the stilts and walked straight toward the road that led to the sea. Nobody saw him bury the stilts. At 5 the next afternoon, the halls of the castle echoed the king's mournful shouts.
Drone! Drone! They're gone! They're gone!
The king stood groping in the empty stilt closet, hopelessly searching for what wasn't there. Lord Drone chuckled to himself. He had expected this to happen and was ready with his lie.
It was the townsfolk who did it,
he said, peering into the stilt closet and pretending to be greatly shocked.
I have seen them every day plotting behind the castle walls. A king, they say, should behave like a king and sit with pomp and dignity upon his royal throne. A king, they say, should never walk on stilts. It's too bad, Your Majesty, but you must try to do without them.
King Bertram answered with a heartbroken sigh. Well, I'll try to do without them. But he couldn't. Day after day, he grew sadder and sadder. For long hours, he'd just sit idly drumming with his fingers on the arms of his throne. He couldn't keep his mind on his work. His commands to the patrol cat sounded feeble and faint. The cat seemed to know it and wouldn't obey. Day by day, they grew lazier and lazier. No one bothered to put their PC badges on them. For as chasers of nizzards, they weren't worth a thing. Day by day, the nizzards grew bolder and bolder. They cackled and fluttered over the dike trees. They flew down and almost seemed to sneer at the lazy, sleeping cats. The townspeople began to feel frightened. The townspeople couldn't keep their minds on their work. They heard nizzards flapping over their rooftops and poked their heads out for a look. Oh, if the cats don't keep those nizzards away from our dike trees, they asked one another. Well, how will the ocean keep back out of our land? Look at those nizzards. Where are the cats? I'll tell you where the cats are, said the townspeople. Everywhere they shouldn't be, and mostly fast asleep. Oh, something must be wrong with the king. Yes, something's certainly wrong with the king. Only Eric, the page boy, knew what was wrong. Finally, one night he could stand it no longer. Drone or no drone, he would go to the king. At dawn the next day, he leapt out of bed and made straight for the castle. Breathless and panting, he raced through the royal gates and up the broad stairs. But Lord Drone saw him coming and stepped quickly forward.
Impudent boy, what are you doing here?
Before Eric could answer and push past him to the king, Lord Drone had grabbed him. And then, with a shrewd, evil grin, Lord Drone said,
Your face! What's wrong with your face? It's red! Oh, it's awfully, awfully red! Measles!
He shouted.
Oh, guards, take him away! Lock him up!
Well, I haven't measles any more than you have,
shouted Eric.
It's a trick, a nasty, droonish trick! Let me talk to the king!
But they dragged poor Eric, fighting and kicking, away from the king and down the castle stairs. 5 minutes later, Eric found himself locked up in an old deserted house on the edge of the town. From the second-story window, he could see the two guards, spears crossed, just below him, barring the door. Through the roof, he could hear the noises of the nizzards. Their beaks were hard as iron and scratched through the air. Eric shuddered and said there must be a way to escape. He thought and he thought. He went to the window and looked down again, and he whistled softly. He had an idea. Quickly, he slipped off his belt. He pushed the end through the buckle and made a lasso. Then he leaned from the window and aimed for the spear points. He dropped the loop. It caught. He jerked the belt tight and tied a quick knot. Look, guards, look, shouted Eric, and he jumped up on the windowsill. Your spears are tied together. If the guards had dropped their spears, they could have caught him in a second. But they didn't. They just yelled at each other and yanked and tugged, stupidly trying to pull the spears apart. By the time they finally had them untied, Eric had sprung to the tree outside his window, slid down the trunk, and quietly escaped. Eric ran. The air was full of the chittering and chattering of nizzards. They were cutting through the clouds like flying black knives, flying nearer, down to earth to eat the dike tree roots, soon to let the sea pour in. Eric ran. He turned a corner. And then he saw water. Oh, he dipped in his finger. Tasted of salt. Seawater. One dike tree must already have eaten clean through. Not a second to lose. I must dig up the stilts. Up the hill to the dike trees where the king's stilts lay buried, right into the very thick of the nizzards, they flapped and screeched about him.
Gritch! Gritch!
Snarled the nizzards. Gritch to you, snapped back Eric, furiously pelting them with fistfuls of mud. He fought and he fought. Finally, his fingers touched the stilts at last. He pulled them from the ground. Stilts bouncing on his shoulder, Eric ran. The road to the castle took him back through the town. The streets were still deserted. The stilts began to hurt his shoulder. Those two stupid guards. I wonder where they are. And then Eric found out all too soon. From around the corner came the guards. And then he heard the angry voice of Lord Droon.
You guards, guards indeed, to let a little pipsqueak of a boy tie up your spears. Dunderhead, search every street, search every house.
Eric heard the clatter of their heavy hobnail boots. No time to run, nowhere to hide. Wait, those clothes in the tailor shop. Eric ducked inside. An instant later, Lord Droon saw a very odd man, a very tall, odd man, coming out from the shop. There was something very odd about the hang of his robe. His hat was pulled down far over his eyes.
Oh, those eyes,
muttered Droon.
Have I seen them before?
The tall man's mouth went suddenly dry.
Are you by any chance seeking a small boy with no belt?
Which way, shouted the guards. Which way did he go?
That way,
said Eric, on his stilts, and he nodded toward the sea. With a clatter of hobnails, the two guards were off, Lord Droon sputtering and scolding along behind them. No time to shrink down to a boy again, thought Eric. I'll have to stay a tall man. And onto the castle, Eric raced in disguise. Then suddenly, just ahead, he saw the king. He was sitting on a little pile of stones just outside the castle gate. Everywhere, he saw patrol cats, useless and limp, fast asleep, near the king. The king's robe wasn't pressed. His crown wasn't shined, and he had deep, sad circles under both of his eyes.
Your Majesty, Your Majesty,
shouted Eric as he clattered up behind him. The king paid no attention. Eric leaned down and shouted right into his ear. Very slowly, the king turned his head.
Well, sighed King Bertram, and who may you be?
I'm Eric.
He let the robe that was covering him drop to the ground. The king's own red flashed bright in the sun. Down from the stilts leapt Eric, the page boy. Up onto the stilts sprang Bertram the king. He drew a great kingly breath, the first one in weeks. His head shot up high, his chest broadened wide. Bertram of Bin was sturdy, straight, and strong again, and every inch a king.
Patrol cats!
It was the loudest command ever shouted in Bin. The king's voice seemed to roll up from deep in the boots. It echoed down the valleys. It rumbled through the hills.
Day cats to left flank, night cats to the right. Charge! The king shouted.
100,000 nizzards dropped their pecking and sprang to meet the charge. The dike trees shook as the cats roared their war cry. The sea surface swirled into wild, raging whirlpools. The noise was heard in Sambaland, 500 miles away. The fur flew fast, but the feathers flew faster. It took only 10 minutes. The kingdom was saved. The townsfolk stopped trembling indoors behind their window shades. They rushed out from their houses and filled the air with cheers. Then the king punished Droon in a most fitting way. He sent him to live by himself with a guard of patrol cats in that old deserted house with a sign that said, Measles, and he made him eat nizzards 3 times every day. Stewed nizzards for breakfast, cold nizzards for lunch, fried nizzards for supper, and every other Thursday they served him nizzard hash. But to Eric, his page boy, the king gave a fine and just reward. He ordered the royal carpenter to make another pair of stilts, tall stilts, red and flashing exactly like his own. From then on, every day at 5, they always raced on stilts together. And when they played, they really played. And when they worked, they really worked. And the cats kept the nizzards away from the dike trees, and the dike trees kept the water back out of the land. And that was the story of The King's Stilts by Dr. Seuss. Well, that's all the time we have, boys and girls. Until we meet again with another Tell Me Again tale, I'm Sheldon Rudolph. Bye for now.
Mayo, the Chichibu region. Bells can be heard as well as the gong. To stress the rhythm, the Yaquis Indians hang bells from their legs and arms. One of the most ancient percussion instruments in the world is the drum. Various carvings and wall paintings on Egyptian and Indian monuments indicate that the drum was in use far back in history. There are many types of drums, varying in size and in the playing technique. In India, the harukas are small wooden drums covered with goatskin. The piece which follows now comes from the district of Uttar Pradesh, and the instruments used are two violins and two harukas. Certain regions of Africa, South America, and the South Seas, the drum is used to send messages from village to village. This tom-tom performance is by a native of Liberia.
in southern Italy, danced on a bed of drums in a contemporary dance, written by Gibante.
Popular drum in northern India is the tabla, which is a double drum, or rather a drum divided in two. The side played with the left hand is called bayan and produces a deep, heavy sound, and that played with the right produces a clear, sharp sound. Listen now to some variations on the tabla and the bayan. Drum is a highly popular instrument in South America, too. This dance comes from Peru, where it is performed by the Titicaca Indians to the beat of the tiña, a small native drum made from a single skin. It's accompanied by a flute. The principal Iranian drum is the dumbak, a hollow wooden or earthenware cylinder covered with a taut skin. Our program ends with a rhythmic fantasy performed on a variety of dumbakas. Thank you.
that excerpt of Music of the Cameroons brings to an end this series, International Music Families, in the UNESCO series on folklore instruments used in different countries. Tonight you heard percussion instruments. This is KPFA and KPFB, Berkeley, listener-supported radio for Northern California.
Well, that's some strange music, isn't it? I don't know that I can fit a story in the little bit that's left on this reel. And rather than get started in the middle of one and have to break off, I think I'll start on the other side, so you can just run it off the end of the reel and start the other side. And you'll meet a friend of yours, I think, at the beginning of the other side. Okay.